He didn't have to tell them. Calixte was a dark-skinned black, bigger and broader than most Haitians Chrysalis had seen so far, and uglier, too. His short, kinky hair was salted with white. His eyes were hidden behind dark glasses, and shriveled scar tissue crawled up the right side of his face. His manner and bearing radiated power, confidence, and ruthless efficiency.
Bonjour.
He bowed a precise little bow. His voice was a deep, hideous rasp, as if the poison that had eaten away the side of his face had also affected his tongue and palate.
Bonjour,
Tachyon replied for them all, bowing a precise millimeter less than Calixte had.
My name is Charlemagne Calixte,
he said in gravelly tones barely louder than a whisper.
President for life Duvalier has charged me with seeing to your safety while you are visiting our island.
Join us, Tachyon offered, indicating the final empty chair. Calixte shook his head as precisely as he'd bowed.
Regretfully, Monsieur Tachyon, I cannot. I have an important appointment for the afternoon. I just stopped by to make sure everything is all right after that unfortunate incident in front of the hotel.
As he spoke, he looked directly at Chrysalis.
Everything's fine,
Tachyon assured him, before Chrysalis could speak.
What I want to know, though, is why the tom-tom...
Ton-ton, Ray said. Tachyon glanced at him.
Of course. The ton-ton, whatevers. Your men, that is, are watching us.
Calixte gave him a look of polite astonishment.
Why, to protect you from that very sort of thing that happened earlier this afternoon.
Protect me? He wasn't protecting me, Chrysalis said. He was beating beggars. Calixte stared at her.
They may have looked like beggars, but many undesirable elements have come into the city.
He looked around the almost empty room, then husked in a barely intelligible whisper.
Communist elements, you know.
They are unhappy with the progressive regime of President for Life Duvalier, and have threatened to topple his government.
No doubt these beggars were communist agitators trying to provoke an incident.
Chrysalis kept quiet, realizing nothing she could say would make any difference. Tachyon was also looking unhappy, but decided not to pursue the matter at this time. After all, they would only be in Haiti one more day before traveling to the Dominican Republic on the other side of the island.
Also,
Calix said with a smile as ugly as his scar,
I am to inform you that dinner tonight at the Palais National will be a formal affair.
And after dinner? Ray said, openly gauging Calixte with his frank stare.
Excuse me?
Is anything planned for after dinner?
But of course.
Several entertainments have been arranged.
There is shopping at the Marché de Fer, the iron market, for locally produced handicrafts. The Musée National will stay open late for those who wish to explore our cultural heritage. You know,
Calix said,
we have on display the anchor from the Santa Maria, which ran aground on our shores during Columbus's first expedition to the New World. Also, of course, galas have been planned in several of our world-famous nightclubs. And for those interested in some of the more exotic local customs, a trip to a Unfor has been arranged.
Unfor? Peregrine asked.
Oui. A temple. A church. A voodoo church.
Sounds interesting, Chrysalis said.
It's gotta be more interesting than looking at anchors, Ray said insouciantly.
Calixte smiled, his good humor going no farther than his lips.
As you wish, monsieur. I must go now.
What about these policemen? Tachyon asked.
They will continue to protect you,
Calixte said depreciatingly, and left.
They're nothing to worry about, Ray said. Leastways while I'm around.
He struck a consciously heroic pose and glanced at Peregrine, who looked down at her drink.
Chrysalis wished she could feel as confident as Ray. There was something unsettling about the Tonton Macoute sitting in the corner of the lounge, watching them from behind his dark glasses with the unblinking patience of a snake. Something malevolent. Chrysalis didn't believe that he was there to protect them. Not for one single solitary second.
Team Malice particularly liked the sensations associated with sex. When he was in the mood for such a sensation, he'd usually mount a female, because, on the whole, females could maintain a state of pleasure, particularly those adept at self-arousal, much longer than his male mounts could. Of course, there were shades and nuances of sexual sensation, some as subtle as silk dragged across a sensitive nipple, some as blatant as an explosive orgasm ripped from a throttled man, and different mounts were adept at different practices. This afternoon, he wasn't in the mood for anything particularly exotic, so he'd attached himself to a young woman who had a particularly sensitive tactile sense and was enjoying itself, when his mount came in to report.
"They'll all be at the dinner tonight, and then the group will break up to attend various entertainments. It shouldn't be difficult to obtain one of them, or more."
He could understand the mount's report well enough. It was, after all, their world, and he'd had to make some accommodations, like learning to associate meaning with the sounds that spilled from their lips. He couldn't reply verbally, of course, even if he'd wanted to. First, his mouth, tongue, and palate weren't shaped for it, and second, his mouth was, and always had to be, fastened to the side of his mount's neck, with the narrow, hollow tube of his tongue plunged into his mount's carotid artery. But he knew his mounts well, and he could read their needs easily. The mount who'd brought the report, for instance, had two. Its eyes were fastened on the lithe nakedness of the female as it pleasured itself, but it also had a need for his kiss. He flapped a pale, skinny hand, and the mount came forward eagerly, dropping its pants and climbing atop the woman. The female let out an explosive grunt as it entered. He forced a stream of spittle down his tongue and into his mount's carotid artery, sealing the breach in it, then gingerly climbed, like a frail, pallid monkey, to the male's back, gripped it around the shoulders, and plunged his tongue home just below the mass of scar tissue on the side of its neck. The male grunted with more than sexual pleasure as he drove his tongue in, siphoning some of the mount's blood into his own body for the oxygen and nutrients he needed to live. He rode the man's back as the man rode the woman, and all three were bound in chains of inexpressible pleasure. And when the carotid of the female mount ruptured unexpectedly, as they sometimes did, spewing all three with pulsing showers of bright, warm, sticky blood, they continued on. It was a most exciting and pleasurable experience. When it was over, he realized that he would miss the female mount. It had had the most incredibly sensitive skin. But his sense of loss was lessened by anticipation. Anticipation of new mounts, and the extraordinary abilities they would have.
2. The Palais National dominated the north end of a large open square near the center of Port-au-Prince. Its architect had cribbed its design from the Capitol building in Washington, D.C., giving it the same colonnaded portico, long white facade, and central dome. Facing it on the south end of the square were what looked like, and in fact were, military barracks. The inside of the Palais stood out in stark contrast to everything else Chrysalis had seen in Haiti. The only word to describe it was opulent. The carpets were deep pile shags. The furniture and bric-a-brac along the hallway they were escorted down by ornately uniformed guards were all authentic antiques. The chandeliers hanging from the high vaulted ceilings were the finest cut crystal. President for life Jean-Claude Duvalier and his wife, Madame Michelle Duvalier, were waiting in a receiving line with other Haitian dignitaries and functionaries. baby Doc Duvalier, who'd inherited Haiti in 1971 when his father, Francois Papa Doc Duvalier, had died, looked like a fat boy who'd outgrown his tight-fitting tuxedo. Chrysalis thought him more petulant-looking than intelligent, more greedy than cunning. It was difficult to imagine how he managed to hold power in a country that was obviously on the brink of utter ruin. Tachyon, wearing an absurd peach-colored crushed velvet tuxedo, was standing to his right, introducing Duvalier to the members of his tour. When it came Chrysalis's turn, baby Doc took her hand and stared at her with the fascination of a young boy with a new toy. He murmured to her politely in French and continued to stare at her as Chrysalis moved down the line. Michel Duvalier stood next to him. She had the cultivated, brittle look of a high-fashion model. She was tall and thin and very light-skinned. Her makeup was immaculate. Her gown was the latest off-the-shoulder designer creation, and she wore lots of costly, gaudy jewelry at her ears, throat, and wrists. Chrysalis admired the expense with which she dressed, if not the taste. She drew back a little as Chrysalis approached and nodded a cold, precise millimeter without offering her hand. Chrysalis sketched an abbreviated curtsy and moved on herself, thinking, bitch. Calixte, showing the high status he enjoyed in the Duvalier regime, was next. He said nothing to her and did nothing to acknowledge her presence, but Chrysalis felt his stare boring into her all the way down the line. It was a most unsettling feeling and was, Chrysalis realized, a further sample of the charisma and power that Calixte wielded. She wondered why he allowed Duvalier to hang around as a figurehead. The rest of the receiving line was a confused blur of faces and handshakes. It ended at the doorway leading into the cavernous dining room. The tablecloths on the long wooden table were linen. The place settings were silver. The centerpieces were fragrant sprays of orchid and rose. When she was escorted to her seat, Chrysalis found that she and the other jokers, Xavier Desmond, Father Squid, Troll, and Dorian Wilde, were stuck at the end of the table. Word was whispered that Madame Duvalier had had them seated as far away from her as possible so the sight of them wouldn't ruin her appetite. However, as wine was being served with the fish course, poisson rouge, the waiter had called it, red snapper served with fresh string beans and fried potatoes, Dorian Wilde stood and recited an extemporaneous, calculatedly overblown ode in praise of Madame Duvalier, all the while gesticulating with the twitching, wriggling, dripping mass of tentacles that was his right hand. Madame Duvalier turned a shade of green, only slightly less bilious than that of the ooze that dripped from Wilde's tendrils, and was seen to eat very little of the following courses. Greg Hartman, sitting near the Duvaliers with the other VIPs, dispatched his pet Doberman, Billy Ray, to escort Wilde back to his seat, and the dinner continued in a more subdued, less interesting manner. As the last of the after-dinner liquors were served and the party started to break up into small conversational groups, Digger Downs approached Chrysalis and stuck his camera in her face. How about a smile, Chrysalis? Or should I say, Deborah Jo? Perhaps you'd care to tell my readers why a native of Tulsa, Oklahoma, speaks with a British accent. Chrysalis smiled a brittle smile, keeping the shock and anger she felt off her face. He knew who she was. The man had pried into her past, had discovered her deepest, if not most vital, secret. How did he do it? She wondered, and what else did he know? She glanced around, but it seemed that no one else was paying them any attention. Billy Ray and Asta Lenzer, the ballerina ace called Fantasy, were closest to them, but they seemed absorbed in their own little confrontation. Billy had a hand on her skinny flank and was pulling her close. She was smiling a slow, enigmatic smile at him. Chrysalis turned back to Digger, somehow managing to keep the anger she felt out of her voice. I have no idea what you're talking about. Digger smiled. He was a rumpled, sallow-looking man. Chrysalis had had dealings with him in the past, and she knew that he was an inveterate snooper who wouldn't let go of a story, especially if it had a juicy, sensational angle. Come, come, Miss Jory. It's all down in black and white on your passport application. She could have sighed with relief, but kept her expression stonily hostile. The application had had her real name on it, but if that was as far as Digger had probed, she'd be safe. Thoughts of her family raced poisonously through her mind. When she was a little girl, she'd been their darling with long blonde hair and a naive young smile. Nothing had been too good for her. Ponies and dolls and baton twirling and piano and dancing lessons. Her father had bought them all for her with his Oklahoma oil money. Her mother had taken her everywhere, to recitals and to church meetings and to society teas. But when the virus had struck her at puberty and turned her skin and flesh invisible, making her a walking abomination, they shut her up in a wing of the ranch house, for her own good, of course, and took away her ponies and her playmates and all contact with the outside world. For 7 years, she was shut up. 7 years. Chrysalis shut off the hateful memories rushing through her mind. She was still, she realized, walking on tricky ground with Digger. She had to concentrate fully on him and forget the family that she'd robbed and fled from. "That information is confidential," she told Digger coldly. He laughed aloud. "That's very funny coming from you," he said, then suddenly sobered at her look of uncontainable fury. "Of course, perhaps the true story of your real past wouldn't be of much interest to my readers." He put a conciliatory expression on his pale face. "I know that you know everything that goes on in Jokertown. Maybe you know something interesting about him." Digger gestured with his chin and let his eyes flicker in the direction of Senator Hartman. "What about him?" Hartman was a powerful and influential politician who felt strongly about Joker's rights. He was one of the few politicians that Chrysalis supported financially because she liked his policies and not because she needed to keep the wheels greased. "Let's go somewhere private and talk about it." Digger was obviously reluctant to discuss Hartman openly. Intrigued, Chrysalis glanced at the antique brooch watch pinned above the bodice of her gown. "I have to leave in 10 minutes. She grinned like a Halloween skeleton. "I'm going to see a voodoo ceremony. Perhaps if you care to come along, we might find time to discuss things and come to a mutual understanding about the newsworthiness of my background." Digger smiled. "Sounds fine to me. Voodoo ceremony, huh? They going to stick pins in dolls and stuff? Maybe have some kind of sacrifice?" Chrysalis shrugged. "I don't know. I've never been to one before." "Think they'll mind if I take photos?" Chrysalis smiled blandly, wishing that she was on familiar turf, wishing that she had something to use on this gossip monger, and wondering, underneath it all, why his interest in Greg Hartman.
In a fit of sentiment, T. Malice chose one of his oldest mounts, a male with a body almost as frail and withered as his own, to be his steed for the night. Even though the mount's flesh was ancient, the brain encased in it was still sharp, and more strong-willed than any other T. Malice had ever encountered. It said, in fact, a lot for T. Malice's own indomitable will that he was able to control the stubborn old steed. The mental fencing that accompanied riding it was a most pleasurable experience. He chose the dungeon for the meeting place. It was a quiet, comfortable old room, full of pleasurable sights and smells and memories. The lighting was dim, the air was cool and moist. His favourite tools, along with the remains of his last few partners in experience, were scattered about in agreeable disarray. He had his mount pick up a blood-encrusted flaying knife and test it on its calloused palm while he drifted in pleasant reminiscence, until the snorting bellow in the corridor outside proclaimed Toro's approach. Toro Trois Grands, as he had named this mount, was a huge male with a body that was thick with slabs of muscle. It had a long, bushy beard, and tufts of coarse black hair peered through the tears in its sun-faded work shirt. It wore frayed, worn denim pants, and it had a huge rampant erection pushing visibly at the fabric that covered its crotch. It always had.
"I have a task for you,"
T. Malice told his mount to say, and Toro bellowed and tossed its head and rubbed its crotch through the fabric of its pants.
"Some new mounts will be awaiting you on the road to Petionville. Take a squad of Zobobs and bring them to me here." Women?
Toro asked in a slobbering snort.
Perhaps, T. Malice said through his mount, but you are not to have them. Later, perhaps.
Toro let out a disappointed bellow, but knew better than to argue.
Be careful, T. Malice warned. Some of these mounts may have powers. They may be strong.
Toro let out a bray that rattled the tattered half-skeleton hanging in the wall niche next to it.
Not as strong as me.
It thumped its massive chest with a calloused, horny hand.
Maybe, maybe not. Just take care. I want them all.
He paused to let his mount's words sink in.
Do not fail me. If you do, you will never know my kiss again.
Toro howled like a steer being led to the slaughter block, backed out of the room, bowing furiously, and was gone. T. Malice and his mount waited. In a moment, a woman came into the room. Its skin was the color of coffee and milk mixed in equal amounts. Its hair, thick and wild, fell to its waist. It was barefooted and obviously wore nothing under its thin white dress. Its arms were slim, its breasts large, and its legs lithely muscled. Its eyes were black irises floating in pools of red. T. Malice would have smiled at the sight of it, if he could, for it was his favourite steed.
Ezilige Rouge,
he crooned through his mount.
You had to wait until Toro left, for you couldn't share a room with the bull and live.
It smiled a smile with even, perfectly white teeth.
It might be an interesting way to die.
It might,
T. Malice considered. He had never experienced death by means of intercourse before.
But I have other needs for you. The Blanks that have come to visit us are rich and important. They live in America and, I'm sure, have access to many interesting sensations that are unavailable on our poor island.
Ezili nodded, licking red lips.
I've set plans in motion to make some of these Blanks mine, but to ensure my success, I want you to go to their hotel, take one of the others, and make it ready for my kiss. Choose one of the strong ones.
Ezili nodded.
Will you take me to America with you?
She asked nervously. T. Malice had his mount reach out an ancient withered hand and caress Azili's large, firm breasts. It shivered with delight at the touch of the mount's hand.
Of course, my darling. Of course.
3. A limousine, Chrysalis said with an icy smile to the broadly grinning man wearing dark glasses who was holding the door for her. How nice. I was expecting something with four-wheel drive. She climbed into the back seat of the limo, and Digger followed her. I wouldn't complain, he said. They haven't let the press go anywhere. You should have seen what I had to go through to crash the dinner party. I don't think they like reporters much. Here. His voice ran down as he flopped onto the rear seat next to Chrysalis and noted the expression on her face. She was staring at the facing seat and the two men who occupied it. One was Dorian Wilde. He was looking more than a little tipsy and fondling a cocoa macaque similar to the one Chrysalis had seen that afternoon. The stick obviously belonged to the man who was sitting next to him and regarding Chrysalis with a horrible frozen grin that contorted his scarred face into a death mask. Chrysalis, my dear, Wilde exclaimed as the limo pulled away into the night. And the glorious Fourth Estate. Dug up any juicy gossip lately? Digger looked from Chrysalis to Wilde to the man sitting next to him and decided that silence would be his most appropriate response. How rude of me, Wilde continued. I haven't introduced our host. This delightful man has the charming name of Charlemagne Calixte. I believe he's a policeman or something. He's going with us to the Unfour.
Digger nodded, and Calixte inclined his head in a precise, non-deferential bow.
Are you a devotee of voodoo, Monsieur Calixte? Chrysalis asked.
It is a superstition of peasants, he said in a raspy growl, thoughtfully fingering the scar tissue that crawled up the right side of his face. Although seeing you would almost make one a believer.
What do you mean?
You have the appearance of a Loa. You could be Madame Brigitte, the wife of Baron Samedi.
You don't believe that, do you? Chrysalis asked.
Calixte laughed. It was a gravelly, barking laugh that was as pleasant as his smile. Not I, but I am an educated man. It was the sickness that caused your appearance. I know. I have seen others.
Other jokers? Digger asked with, Chrysalis thought, his usual tact.
I don't know what you mean. I have seen other unnatural deformities. A few.
Where are they now?
Calixte only smiled. No one felt much like talking. Digger kept shooting Chrysalis questioning glances, but she could tell him nothing, and even if she had an inkling of what was going on, she could hardly speak openly in front of Calixte. Wilde played with Calixte's swagger stick and Cad's drinks from the bottle of Clarin cheap white rum that the Haitian took frequent swallows from himself. Calixte drank over half the bottle in 20 minutes, and as he drank, he stared at Chrysalis with intense bloodshot eyes. Chrysalis, in an effort to avoid Calixte's gaze, looked out the window and was astonished to see that they were no longer in the city, but were traveling down a road that seemed to cut through otherwise unbroken forest.
Just where are we going?
She asked Calixte, striving to keep her voice level and unafraid. He took the bottle of Clarin from Wilde, gulped down a mouthful, and shrugged.
We are going to the Unfour. It is in Pétionville, a small suburb just outside Port-au-Prince.
Port-au-Prince has no Unfours of its own?
Calixte smiled his blasted smile.
None that put on such a fine show.
Silence descended again. Chrysalis knew that they were in trouble, but she couldn't figure out exactly what Calixte wanted of them. She felt like a pawn in a game she didn't even know she'd been playing. She glanced at the others. Digger was looking confused as hell, and Wilde was drunk. Damn. She was more sorry than ever that she'd left familiar, comfortable Joker Town behind to follow Tachyon on his mad, worthless journey. As usual, she only had herself to depend on. It had always been like that, and always would. Part of her mind whispered that once there had been Brennan, but she refused to listen to it. Come to the test, he would have proved as untrustworthy as the rest. He would have. The driver suddenly pulled the limo to the side of the road and killed the engine. She stared out the window but could see little. It was dark, and the roadside was lit only by infrequent glimpses of the half moon, as it occasionally peered out from behind banks of thick clouds. It looked as if they had stopped beside a crossroad, a chance meeting of minor roads that ran blindly through the Haitian forest. Calixte opened the door on his side and climbed out of the limo smoothly and steadily, in spite of the fact that he'd drunk most of a bottle of raw rum in less than half an hour. The driver got out too, leaned against the side of the limo, and began to beat a swift tattoo on a small pointed-end drum that he'd produced from somewhere.
What's going on? Digger demanded.
Engine trouble,
Calixte said succinctly, throwing the empty rum bottle into the jungle.
And the driver is calling the Haitian Automobile Club,
Wilde sprawled across the back seat, said with a giggle. Chrysalis poked Digger and gestured to him to move out. He obeyed, looking around bewilderedly, and she followed him. She didn't want to be trapped in the back of the limo during whatever it was that was going to happen. At least outside the car, she had a chance to run for it, although she probably wouldn't be able to get very far in a floor-length gown and high heels through the jungle on a dark night.
Say, Digger said in sudden comprehension, we're being kidnapped. You can't do this. I'm a reporter.
Calixte reached into his jacket pocket and withdrew a small, snub-nosed revolver. He pointed it negligently at Digger and said, shut up. Downs wisely did. They didn't have long to wait. From the road that intersected the one they'd been driving upon came the cadence sound of marching feet. Chrysalis turned to stare down the road and saw what looked like a column of fireflies, bobbing up and down, coming in their direction. It took a moment, but she realized that it was actually a troop of marching men. They wore long white robes whose hems brushed the road top. Each carried a long, skinny candle in his left hand, and each was also crowned with a candle set on his forehead by a cloth circlet, producing the firefly effect. They wore masks. There were about 15 of them. Leading the column was an immense man who had a decidedly bovine look about him. He was dressed in the cheap, tattered clothes of a Haitian peasant. He was one of the largest men that Chrysalis had ever seen, and as soon as he spotted her, he headed straight toward her. He stood before her, drooling and rubbing his crotch, which Chrysalis was surprised and not happy to see, was bulging outward and stretching the frayed fabric of his jeans. "Jesus," Digger muttered. "We're in trouble now. He's an ace." Chrysalis glanced at the reporter. "How'd you know?"
"Well, he looks like one, doesn't he?"
He looked like someone who'd been touched by the wild card virus, Chrysalis thought, but that didn't necessarily make him an ace. Before she could question Digger further, however, the bull-like man said something in Creole, and Kalik snapped off a guttural "no" in answer. The bull man seemed momentarily ready to dispute Kalik's apparent order, but decided to back down. He continued to glower at Chrysalis and finger his erection as he spoke in turn to the strangely garbed men who had accompanied him. Three of them came forward and dragged a protesting Dorian Wilde from the back seat of the limo. The poet looked around bewilderedly, fixed his bleary eyes on the bull man, and giggled. Calixte grimaced. He snatched his coca macaque from Wilde and lashed out with it, spitting the word "Masisi" as he struck. The blow landed where Wilde's neck curved into his shoulder, and the poet moaned and sagged. The three men supporting him couldn't hold him, and he fell to the ground just as all hell broke loose. The snap, crack, and pop of small arms fire sounded from the foliage bordering the roadside, and a couple of the men, so strangely crowned by candles, went down. A few others broke and ran for it, though most held their ground. The bullman bellowed in rage and hurtled toward the undergrowth. Chrysalis, who dropped to the ground at the first sound of gunfire, saw him get hit in the upper body at least twice, but he didn't even stagger. He crashed into the underbrush, and in a moment, high-pitched screams mixed with his bellowing. Calixte crouched behind the limo and calmly returned fire. Digger, like Chrysalis, was huddled on the ground, and Wilde just lay there moaning. Chrysalis decided that it was time to exercise the better part of valor. She crawled under the limo, cursing as she felt her expensive gown snag and tear. Calixte dove after her. He snatched at her left foot, but only grabbed her shoe. She twisted her foot, the shoe came off, and she was free. She scrambled all the way under the limo, came out on the other side, and rolled into the jungle foliage lining the roadside. She took a few moments to catch her breath, and then was up and running, staying low and keeping to cover as much as she could. Within moments, she was away from the conflict, safe, alone, and she quickly realized, totally, utterly lost. She should have paralleled the road, she told herself, rather than taking off blindly into the forest. She should have done a lot of things, like spending the winter in New York and not on this insane tour. But it was too late to worry about any of that. Now all she could do was push ahead. Chrysalis never imagined that a tropical forest, a jungle, could be so desolate. She saw nothing move, other than tree branches in the night wind, and heard nothing other than the sounds made by that same wind. It was a lonely, frightening feeling, especially to someone used to having a city around them. She'd lost her brooch watch when she'd scrambled under the limo, so she had no way of measuring time other than the increasing soreness in her body and dryness in her throat. Hours certainly had passed before, totally by accident, she stumbled upon a trail. It was rough, narrow, and uneven, obviously made by human feet, but finding it filled her with hope. It was a sign of habitation. It led to somewhere. All she had to do was follow it, and somewhere, sometime, she'd find help. She started down the trail, too consumed by the exigencies of her immediate situation to worry any more about Kellick's motives in bringing her and the others to the crossroads. The identity of the strangely dressed man crowned with candles, or to even wonder about their mysterious rescuers, if indeed the band that had ambushed their kidnappers had meant to rescue them. She walked through the darkness. It was difficult going. Right at the start of her trek, she'd taken off her right shoe to even her stride, and sometime soon afterward, she'd lost it. The ground was not without sticks and stones and other sharp objects, and before long her feet hurt like hell. She cataloged her miseries minutely so she'd know exactly how much to take out of Tachyon's hide if she ever got back to Port-au-Prince. Not if, she told herself repeatedly. When? 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 She was chanting the word as a short, snappy little marching song when she suddenly realized that someone was walking toward her on the trail. It was difficult to say for sure in the uncertain light, but it looked like a man, a tall, frail man carrying a hoe or shovel or something over his shoulder. He was headed right toward her. She stopped, leaned against a nearby tree, and let out a long, relieved sigh. The brief thought flashed through her mind that he might be a member of Kalik's odd gang, but from what she could discern, he was dressed like a peasant, and he was carrying some sort of farm implement. He was probably just a local out on a late errand. She had the sudden fear that her appearance might scare him away before she could ask for help, but quenched it with the realization that he had to have already seen her, and he was still steadily approaching.
Bonjour,
she called out, exhausting most of her French, but the man made no sign that he had heard. He kept on walking past the tree against which she leaned.
Hey, are you deaf?
She reached out and tugged at his arm as he passed by, and as she touched him, he stopped, turned, and fixed her with his gaze. Chrysalis felt as if a slice of night had stabbed into her heart. She went cold and shivery and for a long moment couldn't catch her breath. She couldn't look away from his eyes. They were open. They moved. They shifted focus. They even blinked slowly and ponderously. But they did not see. The face from which they peered was scarcely less skeletal than her own. The brow ridges, eye sockets, cheekbones, jaw, and chin stood out in minute detail, as if there were no flesh between the bone and the taut black skin that covered them. She could count the ribs underneath the ragged work shirt as easily as anyone could count her own. She stared at him as he looked toward her, and her breath caught again when she realized that he wasn't breathing. She would have screamed or run or done something, but as she stared, he took a long, shallow breath that barely inflated his sunken chest. She watched him closely, and 20 seconds passed before he took another. She suddenly realized that she was still holding his ragged sleeve, and she released it. He continued to stare in her direction for a moment or two, then turned back the way he'd been headed and started walking away. Chrysalis stared at his back for a moment, shivering despite the warmth of the evening. She had just seen, talked to, and even touched, she realized, a zombie. As a resident of Joker Town and a Joker herself, she thought herself inured to strangeness, accustomed to the bizarre. But apparently she wasn't. She had never been so afraid in her life, not even when, as a girl barely out of her teens, she had broken into her father's safe to finance her escape from the prison that was her home. She swallowed hard. Zombie or not, he had to be going somewhere. Somewhere where there might be other, real, people. Timorously, because there was nothing else she could do, she began to follow him. They didn't have far to go. He soon turned off onto a smaller, less traveled side trail that wound down and around a steep hill. As they passed a sharp curve in the trail, Chrysalis noticed a light burning ahead. He headed toward the light and she followed him. It was a kerosene lantern, stuck on a pole in front of what looked like a small ramshackle hut clinging to the lower slopes of the precipitous hillside. A tiny garden was in front of the hut, and in front of the garden, a woman was peering into the night. She was the most prosperous-looking Haitian that Chrysalis had yet seen outside of the Palais National. She was actually plump. Her calico dress was fresh and new-looking, and she wore a bright orange Madras bandana wrapped around her head. The woman smiled as Chrysalis and the apparition she was following approached.
Ah, Marcel, who has followed you home? She chuckled.
Madame Brigitte herself, if I am not mistaken.
She sketched a curtsy that, despite her plumpness, was quite graceful. Welcome to my home. Marcel kept walking right on past her, ignoring her and heading for the rear of the hut. Chrysalis stopped before the woman, who was regarding her with an open, welcoming expression that contained a fair amount of good-natured curiosity in it.
Thank you, Chrysalis said hesitantly. There were 1,000 things she could have said, but the question burning in the forefront of her mind had to be answered.
I have to ask you, that is, about Marcel.
Yes.
He's not actually a zombie, is he?
Of course he is, my child.
Of course he is.
Come, come.
She made gathering motions with her hands.
I must go inside and tell my man to call off the search.
Chrysalis hung back.
Search? For you, my child. For you.
The woman shook her head and made tisking sounds.
You shouldn't have run off like that. It caused quite a bit of trouble and worry for us. We thought that the Zobop column might capture you again.
Zobop?
What's a Zobop? It sounded to Chrysalis like a term for some kind of jazz aficionado. It was all she could do to keep from laughing hysterically at the thought.
Zobop are...
The woman gestured vaguely with her hands as if she were trying to describe an enormously complicated subject in simple words.
The assistants of a Bokor, an evil sorcerer, who have sold themselves to the Bokor for material riches. They follow his bidding in all things, often kidnapping victims chosen by the Bokor.
I see. And who, if you don't mind my asking, are you?
The woman laughed good-humoredly.
No, child, I don't mind at all. It shows admirable caution on your part. I am Mambo Julia, priestess and premier reine of the local Bizango chapter.
She must have correctly read the baffled look on Chrysalis's face, for she laughed aloud.
You Blanc are so funny. You think you know everything. You come to Haiti in your great airplane, walk about for one day, and then dispense your magical advice that will cure all our ills. And not once do even one of you leave Port-au-Prince.
Mambo Julia laughed again, this time with some derision.
You know nothing of Haiti. The real Haiti. Port-au-Prince is a gigantic cancer that shelters the leeches that are sucking the juices from Haiti's body. But the countryside, ah, the countryside is Haiti's heart.
Well, my child, I shall tell you everything you need to know to begin to understand. Everything and more than you want to know. Come to my hut, rest, drink, have a little something to eat, and listen.
Chrysalis considered the woman's offer. Right now, she was more concerned about her own difficulties than Haiti's. But Mambo Julia's invitation sounded good. She wanted to rest her aching feet and drink something cold. The idea of food also sounded inviting. It seemed as if she'd last eaten years ago.
All right, she said, following Mambo Julia toward the hut.
Before they reached the door, a middle-aged man, thin, like most Haitians, with a shock of premature white hair, came around from the back.
Baptiste, Mambo Julia cried, have you fed the zombie?
The man nodded and bobbed a courteous bow in Chrysalis's direction.
Good. Tell the others that Madame Brigitte has found her own way home.
He bowed again, and Chrysalis and Mambo Julia went into the hut. Inside, it was plainly, neatly, comfortably furnished. Mambo Julia ushered Chrysalis to a rough-hewn plank table and served her fresh water and a selection of fresh, succulent tropical fruits, most of which were unfamiliar, but tasty. Outside, a drum began to beat a complicated rhythm to the night. Inside, Mambo Julia began to talk.
One of T. Malice's mounts delivered Azili's message at midnight. It had succeeded in the task he'd given it. A new mount was lying in drug slumber at the Royal Haitian Hotel, awaiting its first kiss. Excited as a child on Christmas morning, T. Malice decided that he couldn't wait at the fortress for the mounts he'd sent Taro after to be delivered. He wanted new blood, and he wanted it now. he moved from his old favourite to a different mount, a girl not much bigger than he, that was already waiting in the special box that he'd had built for occasions when he had to move about in public. It was the size of a large suitcase and was cramped and uncomfortable, but it afforded the privacy he needed for his public excursions. It took a bit of caution, but T. Malice was smuggled unseen to the third floor of the Royal Haitian Hotel, where Azili, naked and hair flying wild, led him into the room and stood back while the mount bearing him opened the lid and stepped from the box as he moved from the girl's chest to the more comfortable position upon its back and shoulders. Azili led him into the bedroom where his new mount was sleeping peacefully.
"He wanted me the moment he saw me," Azili said. "It was easy to get him to bring me here, and easier yet to slip the draught into his drink after he had me."
She pouted, fingering the large dark nipple of her left breast.
"He was a quick lover," she said with some disappointment.
"Later," T. Malice said through his mount, "you shall be rewarded."
Azili smiled happily as T. Malice ordered his mount to bring him closer to the bed. The mount complied, bending over the sleeping man, and T. Malice transferred himself quickly. He snuggled against the man's chest, nuzzling its neck. The man stirred, moaned a little in its drugged sleep. T. Malice found the spot he needed, bit down with his single sharp tooth, then drove his tongue home. The new mount groaned and feebly reached for its neck, but T. Malice was already firmly in place, mixing his saliva with his mount's blood, and the mount subsided like a grumpy child having a slightly bad dream. It settled down into deep sleep while T. Malice made it his. It was a splendid mount, powerful and strong. Its blood tasted wonderful.
4.
"There have always been two Haitis," Mambo Julia said. "There is the city, Port-au-Prince, where the government and its law rule, and there is the countryside, where the Bazango rules."
"You used that word before," Chrysalis said, wiping the sweet juices of a succulent tropical fruit off her chin. "What does it mean?"
"As your skeleton, which I can see so clearly, holds your body together, so the Bizango binds the people of the countryside. It is an organization, a society with a network of obligations and order. Not everyone belongs to it, but everyone has a place in it, and all abide by its decisions. The Bizango settles disputes that would otherwise rip us apart. Sometimes it is easy. Sometimes, as when someone is sentenced to become a zombie, it is difficult."
"The Bizango sentenced Marcel to become a zombie?"
Mambo Julia nodded. "He was a bad man. We in Haiti are more permissive about certain things than you Americans. Marcel liked girls. There is nothing wrong with that. Many men have several women. It is all right as long as they can support them and their children. But Marcel liked young girls. Very young girls. He couldn't stop, so the Bizango sat in judgment and sentenced him to become a zombie."
"They turned him into a zombie?"
"No, my dear. They judged him." Mambo Julia lost her air of convivial jollity. "I made him into what he is today, and keep him that way by the powders I feed him daily."
Chrysalis placed the half-eaten fruit she was holding back upon its plate, having suddenly lost her appetite.
"It is a most sensible solution. Marcel no longer harms young girls. He is, instead, a tireless worker for the good of the community."
"And he'll always be a zombie?"
"Well, there have been a few zombie savants, those who have been buried and brought back as zombies, then somehow managed to return to the state of the living." Mambo Julia plucked her chin thoughtfully. "But such have always remained somewhat impaired."
Chrysalis swallowed hard.
I appreciate what you've done for me. I'm not sure what Calixte intended, but I'm sure he meant me harm. But now that I'm free, I'd like to return to Port-au-Prince.
Of course you do, child. And you shall. In fact, we were planning on it.
Mambo Julia's words were welcome, but Chrysalis wasn't sure that she cared much for her tone.
What do you mean?
Mambo Julia looked at her seriously.
I am not sure either what Calixte planned for you. I do know that he's been collecting people such as yourself. People who've been changed. I don't know what he does to them, but they become his. They do the dirty deeds that even the Tonton Macoute refuse. And he keeps them busy, she said with a clenched jaw.
Charlemagne Calixte is our enemy. He is the power in Port-au-Prince. Jean-Claude Duvalier's father, François, was in his own way a great man. He was ruthless and ambitious. He found his way into power and held it for many years. He first organized the Tonton Macoute, and they helped him line his pockets with the wealth of an entire country. But Jean-Claude is unlike his father. He is foolish and weak-willed. He has allowed the real power to flow into Calixte's hands, and the devil is so greedy that he threatens to suck the life from us like a loup-garou. She shook her head. He must be stopped. His stranglehold must be loosened, so the blood will flow through Haiti's veins again. But his power runs deeper than the guns of the Tonton Macoute. He is either a powerful Bokor, or he has one working for him. The magic of this Bokor is very strong. It has enabled Calixte to survive several assassination attempts. Though one of them, at least, she said with some satisfaction, left its mark on him. What has all this to do with me? Chrysalis asked. You should go to the United Nations or the media. Let your story be known.
The world knows our story, Mambo Julia said, and doesn't care. We are beneath their notice, and perhaps it is best that we are left to work out our problems in our own way.
How?
Chrysalis asked, not sure that she wanted to know the answer.
The Bizango is stronger in the country than in the city, but we have our agents even in Port-au-Prince. We've been watching you, Blanc, since your arrival, thinking that Calixte might be bold enough to somehow take advantage of your presence, perhaps even try to make one of you his agent. When you publicly defied the Tonton Macoute, we knew that Calixte would be driven to get even with you. We kept close watch over you, and so were able to foil his attempt to kidnap you. But he did manage to take your friends.
They're not my friends, Chrysalis said, starting to realize where Mambo Julia's argument was heading. And even if they were, I couldn't help you rescue them.
She held her hand up, a skeleton's hand with a network of cord and sinew and blood vessels woven around it. This is what the wild card virus did to me. It didn't give me any special powers or abilities. You need someone like Billy Ray, or Lady Black, a golden boy, to help you.
Mambo Julia shook her head. We need you. You are Madame Brigitte, the wife of Baron Samedi.
You don't believe that?
No, she said. But the chasseurs and soldats who live in the small scattered hamlets, who cannot read and who have never seen television, who know nothing of what you call the wild card virus. They may look upon you and take heart for the deeds they must do tonight. They may not totally believe either, but they will want to, and will not think upon the impossibility of defeating the Bokor and his powerful magic.
Besides, she said with some finality, you are the only one who can bait the trap. You are the only one who escaped the Zobop column. You will be the only one who will be accepted into their stronghold.
Mambo Julia's words both chilled and angered Chrysalis. Chilled her because she never even wanted to see Calixte again. She had no intention of putting herself in his power. angered her because she didn't want to become mixed up in their problems, to die for something she knew virtually nothing about. She was a saloon keeper, an information broker. She wasn't a meddling ace who stuck her nose in where it didn't belong. She wasn't an ace of any kind. Chrysalis pushed her chair away from the table and stood up.
Well, I'm sorry, but I can't help you. Besides, I don't know where Calix took Digger and Wild any more than you do.
But we do know where they are, Mambo Julia smiled a smile totally devoid of humor. Though you eluded the Chasseur who was sent to rescue you, several of the Zobop did not. It took some persuading, but one finally told us that Calix's stronghold is Fort Mercredi, the ruined fortress overlooking Port-au-Prince. The center of his magic is there.
Mambo Julia stood herself and went to open the door. A group of men stood in front of the hut. They all had the look of the country about them in their rough farm clothes, calloused hands and feet, and lean, muscular bodies.
Tonight, Mambo Julia said, the Bokor dies once and for all.
Their voices rose in a murmur of surprise and awe when they saw Chrysalis.
Most bowed in a gesture of respect and obeisance. Mambo Julia cried out in Creole, gesturing at Chrysalis, and they answered her loudly, happily. After a few moments, she closed the door, turned back to Chrysalis, and smiled. Chrysalis sighed. It was foolish, she decided, to argue with a woman who had the demonstrated ability to create zombies. The feeling of helplessness that descended over her was an old feeling, a feeling from her youth. In New York, she controlled everything. Here, it seemed, she was always controlled. She didn't like it, but there was nothing she could do but listen to Mambo Julia's plan. It was a rather simple plan. Two Bizongo Chasseur, men with the rank of hunter in the Bizongo, Mambo Julia explained, would dress in the Zobop robes and masks that they'd captured earlier that evening, bring Chrysalis to Calix's fortress, and tell him that they tracked her down in the forest. When the opportunity presented itself, Chrysalis wasn't pleased with the plan's vagueness on this point, but thought it best to keep her mouth shut, they would let their comrades in and proceed to destroy Calix and his henchmen. Chrysalis didn't like it, even though Mambo Julia assured her airily that she would be perfectly safe, that the Loa would watch over her. For further protection, unnecessary as it was, Mambo Julia said, the priestess gave her a small bundle wrapped in oilskin.
This is a paquet Congo, Mambo Julia told her. I made it myself. It contains very strong magic that will protect you from evil. If you are threatened, open it and spread its contents all around you. But do not let any touch yourself. It is strong magic, very, very strong, and you can only use it in the simplest way.
With that, Mambo Julia sent her off with the Chasseur. There were 10 or 12 of them, young to middle-aged. Baptiste, Mambo Julia's man, was among them. They continually chattered and joked among themselves as if they were going on a picnic, and they treated Chrysalis with the utmost deference and respect, helping her over the rough spots on the trail. Two carried robes they had taken from the Zobop column earlier that evening. The foot trail they followed led to a rough road where an ancient vehicle, a minibus or van of some kind, was parked. It hardly looked capable of moving, but the engine started right up after everyone had piled in. The trip was slow and bumpy, but they made better time when they eventually turned off onto a wider graded road that eventually led back to Port-au-Prince. The city was quiet, although they did occasionally pass other vehicles. It struck Chrysalis that they were traveling through familiar scenery, and she suddenly realized that they were in Balas, the slum section of Port-au-Prince where the hospital she'd visited that morning, it seemed like 1,000 years ago, was located. The men sang songs, chattered, laughed, and told jokes. It was hard to believe that they were planning to assassinate the most powerful man in the Haitian government, a man who was reputedly an evil sorcerer as well. They were acting more as if they were going to a ball game. It was either a remarkable display of bravado or the calming effect of her presence as Madame Brigitte. Whatever caused their attitude, Chrysalis didn't share it. She was scared stiff.
The driver suddenly pulled over and silence fell as he parked the minibus on a narrow street of dilapidated buildings, pointed, and said something in Creole. The chasseur began to disembark, and one courteously offered Chrysalis a hand down. For a moment, she thought of running, but saw that Baptiste was keeping a wary, if inconspicuous, eye on her. She sighed to herself and joined the line of men as they walked quietly up the street. It was a strenuous climb up a steep hill. After a moment, Chrysalis realized that they were heading toward the ruins of a fort that she had first noticed when they passed through the area earlier in the day. Fort Mercredi, Mambo Julia had called it. It had looked picturesque in the morning. Now it was a dark, looming wreck with an aura of brooding menace about it. The column stopped and a small copse of trees clustered in front of the ruins, and two chasseurs, one of them Baptiste, changed into the Zobop robes and masks. Baptiste courteously motioned Chrysalis forward, and she took a deep breath, willed her legs to stop trembling, and went on. Baptiste took her arm above her elbow, ostensibly to show that she was a prisoner, but she was grateful for the warmth of a human touch. The shaft of night had returned to her heart, but it had grown, had spread until it felt like a dark, icy curtain that had totally enveloped her chest. The fortress was encircled by a dry moat that had a dilapidated wooden bridge spanning it. They were challenged as they reached the bridge by a voice that shouted a question in Creole. Baptiste answered satisfactorily with a curt password. More information, Chrysalis guessed, wrenched from the unfortunate Zobop who'd fallen into the hands of the Bizongo, and they crossed the bridge. Two men wearing the semi-official blue suit of the Tonton Macoute were lounging on the other side, their dark glasses resting in their breast pockets. Baptiste told them some long, involved story, and looking impressed, they passed them on through the outer defenses of the citadel. They were challenged again in the courtyard beyond, and again passed on, this time led into the interior of the decrepit fort by one of the second pair of guards. Chrysalis found it maddening not to understand what was being said around her. The tension was growing higher, her heart colder, as fear wound her tighter than a compressed spring. There was nothing she could do, though, but endure it, and hope, however hopelessly, for the best. The interior of the fortress seemed to be in moderately good repair. It was lit, medievally enough, by infrequent torches and wall niches. The walls and flooring were stone, dry and cool to the touch. The corridor ended at a railless spiral staircase of crumbling stone. The Tonton Macoute led them downward. Images of a dank dungeon began to dance in Chrysalis's mind. The air took on a damp feel and a mildewy smell. The staircase itself was slippery with unidentifiable ooze and difficult to negotiate in the sandals, made from bits of old automobile tires that Mambo Julia had given her. Torches were infrequent, and the pools of light they threw didn't overlap, so they often had to pass through patches of total darkness. The staircase ended in a large open space that had only a few uncomfortable-looking bits of wooden furniture in it. A series of chambers debouched off this area, and it was to one of these that they were led. The room was 20 feet on a side and lit better than the corridors through which they'd just passed, but the ceiling, corners, and some spots along the back wall were all in darkness. The dancing light thrown by the torches made it difficult to discern details, and after her first glance inside the room, Chrysalis knew that was probably for the best. It was a torture chamber, lined with antique devices that looked well cared for and recently used. An iron maiden lay half open against one wall, the spikes in its interior coated by flakes of either rust or blood. A table loaded down with impedimenta, such as pokers and cleavers and scalpels, and thumb and foot screws, stood next to what Chrysalis imagined was a rack. She didn't know for certain because she'd never seen one, never thought she would see one. Never, ever wanted to see one. She looked away from the instruments of torture and focused on the group of half a dozen men clustered in the rear of the room. Two were Tonton Macoute, enjoying the proceedings. The others were Digger Downs and Dorian Wild, the bullman who had led the Zobop column, and Charlemagne Calixte. Downs was shackled in a wall niche next to a moldering skeleton. Wild was the center of everyone's attention. A stout, thick beam stuck out from the dungeon's rear wall, close to the ceiling parallel to the floor. A block and tackle hung from the beam, and a rope descended from the sharp, wicked-looking metal hook at the bottom of the block and tackle set. Dorian Wilde was dangling from the rope by his arms. He was trying to haul himself up, but lacked the muscular strength to do so. He couldn't even get a proper grip on the coarse hemp with the mass of tentacles that was his right hand. Sweating, wild-eyed, and straining, he swayed desperately while Calixte operated a ratcheted hand crank that lowered the rope until the bottoms of Wilde's naked feet were hanging just above a bed of hot glowing coals burning in a low brazier that had been placed below the gibbet. Wilde would desperately swing his feet away from the searing heat. Calixte would crank him up and give him a brief respite, then lower him again. He stopped when the bullman glanced toward the front of the room, noticed Chrysalis, and let out a bellow. Calixte looked at her and their eyes met. His expression was wildly exultant, and he was sweating profusely, though it was damply cool in the dungeon. He smiled and said something in Creole to the men in the background, who sprang forward and removed Wilde from the gibbet. He then spoke to Baptiste and the other chasseur. Baptiste must have answered him satisfactorily, for he nodded, then dismissed them with a curt word and a gesture of his head. They bowed and started to walk away. Chrysalis took a single instinctive step to follow them, and then the bullman was before her, breathing heavily and eyeing her strangely. His erection, she noted sickly, was still rampant.
"Well," Calixte growled in English, "we are all together again."
He came to Chrysalis, put a hand on the bull's shoulder, and pushed him away.
"We were having a bit of amusement. The Blanc offended me, and I was teaching him some manners."
He nodded at Wilde, who was huddled on the damp flagstone paving, heaving great shuddering breaths. Calixte never took his eyes off Chrysalis. They were bright and fevered, burning with unspeakable excitement and pleasure.
"You also have been difficult."
He plucked at the scar tissue that glinted glassily in the torchlight. He seemed deep in mad thought.
"You need, I think, a lesson also."
He seemed to make up his mind.
"He'll have the others. I don't think he'd mind if we used you up. Toro,"
he turned to the bullman, spoke some words in Creole. Chrysalis scarcely understood him, even though he spoke English. His words were thick and blurry, even more so than usual. He was either very drunk, very stoned, or very mad. Perhaps she realized all three. She was frantic with terror. The chasseurs weren't supposed to leave, she thought wildly. They were supposed to kill Calixte. Her heart beat faster than the drums she'd heard sounding through the Haitian night. The dark fear centered in her chest threatened to flow out and overwhelm her entire being. For a moment, she teetered on the thin edge of irrationality, and then Truro came forward, snorting and drooling, one massive hand unbuttoning the fly of his jeans, and Chrysalis knew what she had to do. She clutched the packet that Mambo Julia had given her, and with frantic, shaking fingers, pulled off the paper wrapping, exposing a small leather sack closed by a drawstring. She ripped open the mouth of the sack, and with trembling hands, threw it and its contents at Toro. The sack hit him in the face, and he walked right into a cloud of fine, grayish powder that billowed out from it. It coated his hands, arms, chest, and face. He stopped for a moment, snorted, shook his head, then kept right on coming. Chrysalis broke. She turned with a sob and started to run, thinking incoherently that she should have known better, that Mambo Julia was a conniving fraud, that what was about to happen was nothing compared to what she would experience in a lifetime of domination by Calixte. And then she heard a horrible, bellowing scream that froze every nerve, muscle, and sinew in her body. She turned. Toro was standing still, but shivering from head to toe as every massive muscle in his body spasmed. His eyes nearly bulged from his head as he stared at Chrysalis and screamed again, a horrible, drawn-out wail that wasn't even remotely human. His hands clenched and unclenched, and then he began to rake at his face, tearing long furrows of meat away from his cheeks with his thick, blunt fingernails. howling all the while like a damned soul burning. A memory flashed through Chrysalis's mind, a terse recollection of a cool, dark bar, a delightful drink, and a short tachyon speech on Haitian herbal medicine. Mambo Julia's Peke Congo contained no magic powder, no concoction compounded during a fearful ritual and consecrated to the dark voodoo loa. It was simply some herbal preparation, a fast-acting, topically effective neurotoxin of some kind. At least that's what she told herself and almost believed.